Hi everyone, this is Minnie and I'm incredibly excited to be sitting opposite Dr. Betsy Mills here today, who's going to tell us a little bit about her amazing work on the Milky Way. Do you want to say hi, Betsy?
Hi everyone.
So Betsy, you and I met when we were both postdocs at NRAO in Socorro. Would you like to just give us a brief introduction of who you are, where you are now, and what you're currently doing?
Right now, I'm a bit of a world traveler. So normally I'm based as a postdoc. So I finished my PhD in 2013. And so right now I'm a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Arizona. I'm actually spending the summer in Heidelberg, Germany. And that means that I was close enough to come up here to Manchester and Jodrell Bank to see Minnie. And then in August, I'll actually be moving to start as a professor at San Jose State.
That's so exciting, Professor Mills. So Betsy didn't say this, but she's actually a Jansky Fellow right now, which is one of the prestigious postdocs offered by NRAO. So Betsy leads her own research program in the Milky Way. So Betsy, you just gave a fantastic talk, our lunch meeting just now on the Milky Way. And afterwards, everybody was like, well, that's really cool. So you've got some super high resolution images of the Milky Way. I didn't realize that we knew so little about the center of our galaxy. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah, so actually the center of our galaxy is a very difficult region to observe. So of course we live inside of our galaxy, and it's shaped a little bit, for our older listeners, like a compact disc. So it's actually very, very thin.
Is that like an MP3?
Very large.
I don't understand.
A little bit different shaped. And so we live inside of this pancake, basically. And so to look toward the center of the pancake, you have to look through a whole lot of pancake. In this case, you have to look through a lot of gas and a lot of dust, and that can block our view as we look toward the center of our galaxy.
That sounds like a dirty pancake.
It's not the cleanest. But we're interested in what's in the very center. And so radio wavelengths and millimeter wavelengths like ALMA uses can actually help us see through all of that. So it actually becomes almost invisible. So you can see right to the center where there's, for example, a very, very big, supermassive black hole. It weighs more than a million times as much as our sun, and it's really tiny. And one of the things we want to understand, because it's very small in its actual size, but of course it contains a lot of mass, we want to understand how it actually grows. So how do you actually get gas from the rest of our galaxy down onto this tiny central object that gets bigger and bigger?
So it's a lot of mass, a million times the mass of the sun, in a really, really small area.
Yes.
That's insane. And how do you put lots of stuff on it? And how do you see down to there? So you're looking at wavelengths, you said, with ALMA, which is the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. I should know that. And so you're using wavelengths of, you know, a fraction of a millimeter up to a few centimeters.
Yeah, and so for me, so I'm actually looking at some of the closest gas and dust to that black hole. But in this case, close actually means about as far away from the black hole as we are from Alpha Centauri. So about as far away as the nearest star. And that actually is really close when you're talking about something that's this big and is surrounded by a lot of really massive O stars and giant stars that are very hot, and all of this is giving off lots of UV light, right? Like the kind that burns our skin, and it's giving off lots of X-rays. And so it's this really extreme environment for this gas to be sort of heated and also tugged on by the gravity of the black hole.
Wow, that's so cool. And you had a really cool image in your talk where you were looking at something like a fraction of a parsec, you said, within a light year, and you can see the trails of the stars actually, not their trails, their orbits being affected by the pull of the big black hole.
Yeah, so one of the ways that we actually know that this black hole is as big as it is we can actually see, and this is using now infrared telescopes like Keck, for example, you can actually get so close to the black hole that you can see a star going around the black hole, and you can see it move around with an orbital period of something like 10 years. And so you can actually measure the orbit of this star, and based on how fast it goes and how far away it is from the black hole, you can figure out how much the black hole weighs. It's very much like how we can use our own Earth and say that we go around in a year and we're about an astronomical unit away from it and actually measure how much our sun weighs.
That is really cool. So you talked about the fact that prior to ALMA, or prior to the high resolution data that we have now, we had fairly low resolution data from single dish telescopes. And then you personally got some brand new ALMA data. You said it was 100 times better resolution than...
We're doing a lot better, yeah. So we used to be able to look at this with single-dish telescopes with maybe 30 arc-second resolution. And now we're getting down to a fraction, maybe even a half of an arc-second resolution. And that's a really big deal when something is as far away as the center of our galaxy is. So it's about 30,000 light-years, or about 8 kiloparsecs away from us. And so that means that even with the resolution that we have, if you're looking at something that's maybe 30 arc seconds across, that's just a parsec in size. So again, in the center of our galaxy, inside of a parsec, you can cram in a black hole, you can cram in hundreds of thousands of stars, you can cram in thousands of solar masses worth of gas. And if you actually want to distinguish between all of this and where the gas is relative to the stars and the black hole, you really need much, much higher resolution like ALMA can provide. So we're getting down into sort of a hundredth of a parsec resolution. And we can actually start seeing these individual clumps of gas as they go around the black hole, gas that might eventually fall into the black hole or might form stars there.
That's so cool. So somebody asked you in the talk, how do you know that these stars are formed right near the black hole as opposed to being thrown in or captured gravitationally?
So there's a big mystery, because the stars that people use to measure the mass of the black hole, these are all actually fairly young stars. And you have to take this in terms of astronomical terms. So if you said that you or I were very old, right, we might be, you know, getting up into our 40s or 50s. But for here, We're young, like these stars. But these stars, being young as a star means that you might only be a few million years old, right? Compared to, say, maybe the billions of years that a star like our sun has lived, which is getting a little bit old.
So our sun's, what, 5 billion?
Yeah, our sun is maybe 4.5-5 billion years old. And so these are only a few million years old. So they formed much, much earlier. And so the thing is, one of the things that we don't understand is how they got there, right? Because you're so close to this black hole, it has such strong gravity that it should be pulling very hard. So as a gas cloud tries to collapse and get smaller, at the same time it will be pulled farther apart by the black hole. So you either need a lot of gas crammed into a very, very small region, or possibly you have to say maybe these stars were born somewhere else and came closer in. But we think that's really unlikely because of how young they are. So even though a million years seems like a very long time to us, actually it would be very surprising to get sort of hundreds and thousands of stars that young that close to the black hole in such a short amount of time.
So what have your new BLA and ALMA observations told you about how these stars formed or where they came from?
Yeah, so one of the things that's interesting about our observations is we have, again, for the first time, some very, very sensitive and very high-resolution measurements of the molecular gas. And this is the gas that will form the next generation of stars. And so we see a couple things there. One is that there isn't any gas as close to the black hole as we see those very young stars that trace the orbits around the black hole.
There's no gas there?
Yeah, so the stars are still there, but they formed a million years ago, and there's none of that gas still left there.
So we finished making stars.
We finished making stars there, and it doesn't look like there's any more gas to make new stars there yet. So all of the gas that we see is maybe 10 or 100 times further away from the black hole than those stars are. And one of the other things we see about that gas is even though it's further from the black hole, and the tug of the black hole is less, it's still not quite enough gas to form stars where it is right now. So it seems like all of this gas is sort of in a holding pattern right now, and it's waiting to maybe build up enough gas and for that gas to be close enough together and dense enough to actually form new stars there for the future.
That's really, really cool. And you also talked a lot about the densities required and your observations of CO, carbon monoxide, don't trace the densest gases?
So we have to look at a lot of different tracers, especially because this is such an extreme environment and there's so much going on, that there might be X-rays, there might be cosmic rays, which are also like really high energy, but now instead of throwing an electron or a photon around, you're throwing around like a proton, like a big massive particle, but really, really fast. So you have all this crazy high energy stuff there, and that can really affect the gas and the chemistry. And it can mean that some molecules might be destroyed by the X-rays, while some might actually be enhanced by them. And so to get a sense of what the gas is doing, you actually need to look at a number of different molecules. So some molecules like CO, for example, live in lower density gas.
Right. How many different molecules are you able to trace with your data?
So with our data, we're able to see about almost 30 different molecules in the gas around the black hole. And they range in complexity from as simple as something like CO to something that might have 7 atoms and be a lot of different carbon molecules strung together. We call that a carbon chain molecule.
Wow. Yeah, for my own work, the only spectral line I'm familiar with at the radio regime is H1, 21 centimeter line.
So I like to say that the gas I look at in the galactic center is gas that's usually smelly or poisonous or both. So I look at a lot of things like ammonia and hydrogen cyanide.
Sounds like a fun place.
And they're very good, to measure what's going on in the gas. But they're not anything that you would necessarily want in your kitchen or your backyard.
So you can measure, temperatures, densities?
So using these molecules, we can tell a lot, actually, about what the gas is doing. So we're not just looking at these molecules to figure out where they are.
Right.
We're actually looking at the molecules to tell us about the gas that they are interacting with. So one of the big problems that we have in astronomy is the number one thing that's in space that was made by the Big Bang is hydrogen. And so most of the molecular gas in our galaxy is very simple. It's two hydrogen atoms stuck together. So we call that H2. And the real problem is that the special properties of this molecule, and I'm just going to sort of allude to quantum mechanics here very generally, mean that it's invisible to us when it's cold. It really just doesn't give off light in a way that we can detect.
Right.
Tell that it's there. And so we have to use other molecules to tell us what this gas is doing. And so we might use, for example, a molecule that's very lightweight, like ammonia or CO, and as it bumps against the H2 molecules, it will actually very quickly come to the same temperature as those molecules. So it's just like sticking a thermometer in your mouth or in a glass of water. We use these molecules like a thermometer to tell us what's the temperature of the H2.
Okay.
And something like CO or HCN will also, as it bumps against these molecules, that's how it gets its energy.
Right.
So the more times it bumps against molecules, the more energy it has. And that also means, likely, the way that you increase the chance it's going to bump against another molecule is that the molecules are closer together, that they're denser, right?
So what is the temperature of the environment near the black hole?
It's actually very extreme. So, and this is another thing where you have to say that it's extreme for astronomers, right? So for molecular gas that's cold, right, normally out in space, it might be something like 10 Kelvin, right?
That's very cold.
That's quite cold, yes.
-263
So room temperature here is about 300 Kelvin. So I am looking at gas that's 200 Kelvin, and that's actually quite hot for gas that's in space, in the cold darkness of space.
But I still want to wear a jacket. Stars.
Yeah. So even though it's much colder than anything we would have on Earth, out in space, that's pretty hot.
That's insane. I mean, that's just one black hole heating up this giant area.
Well, it's one black hole and thousands of stars.
That
so
is
the
true.
Thing about the center of our galaxy is the number of stars and the concentration of stars increases as you go to the center. So as you get to the very center, you have one of the highest concentrations of stars in our galaxy.
And that's just because of the black hole? Or?
Well, we're not actually sure about this. It's something that we see in general in centers of galaxies, that most galaxies as big as ours have a black hole in the center.
Right.
And many galaxies also have what we call a nuclear star cluster in the center, which is something like a globular cluster, so millions of stars, very old. The center of that globular cluster in the center of a galaxy is a black hole. And so we see this in our galaxy. There are a few galaxies, for example, like our neighbor M33, that has a nuclear star cluster but no black hole. So it's not entirely clear whether they're forming in the same way or through slightly different processes.
Right, so that's always bothered me because, as regular listeners know, there's obviously some correlation with the growth of the galaxy and the growth of the black hole, but the black holes are really, really small, and the sphere of influence isn't that big. So how does, I mean, the big bulge, I suppose you've got things spinning up and it's just, galaxies make no sense to me.
It's very strange. Yeah, so the gas that I'm actually talking about when I mentioned the circumnuclear disk of gas around the black hole, even at its distance of being about 3 or 4 light years away from the black hole,
which is really close.
Which is really close. That's actually already far enough that it's feeling basically equal or even more of the gravity coming from the stars around the black hole than just from the black hole itself.
Wow. That's really neat. I know you use a lot of ALMA data, but you've also combined this with VLA data, with data from other telescopes. Why do you need data from all these different instruments?
So I like to get data from as many places as I possibly can to figure out what's going on in these regions. And partly that's because you're really limited, as I said, when you look toward the center of the galaxy. Because wavelengths like optical wavelengths, like we would normally see with our eyes, ultraviolet wavelengths, you just can't see those at all because it's totally blocked by the gas and dust.
Right.
So if you want to understand sort of the full picture and the full cycle of how gas turns to stars, and those stars then influence, they heat and ionize that gas, you really need a lot of different wavelengths to probe these components that might vary. For example, the molecular gas might be anywhere from 50 to 200 Kelvin, whereas the stars are up at 10,000 Kelvin or hotter. And so you really need very different wavelengths to probe this wide range of temperatures of all of these different stages.
Right, so for us to build up a comprehensive picture, I mean, getting multi-wavelength data is absolutely imperative. And that's also true for my own research in the extragalactic universe. So Betsy, tell me one recent amazing Milky Way discovery that our listeners might not know about.
I actually tend to, this is a little bit ironic, but I actually tend to get very excited about things that are actually a little bit outside of my field of research, especially things related to exoplanets. So I'm actually one of a type of astronomer that's married to another astronomer. And so this problem, we often call this in the field the two-body problem, of actually trying for both of us to find jobs and make it as astronomers. And so my husband studies exoplanets, and this is something that I love to hear about and I love to talk to other people about, because it's so fascinating to actually be thinking of trying to get closer to find worlds that are like our own,
right,
and whether or not they have atmospheres.
I must say, I've never given a public talk without somebody asking me about aliens or inhabitable planets.
For me, it's a little easier because once I mention black hole, that's obviously the question magnet.
Right.
That's what people will go to. But I'm still fabulously excited by the star that they found with the Kepler mission, which is looking at the brightness of stars to see dips that might come from planets.
Right.
The star that has such funny dips in it, where they think that it might be surrounded by a cloud of comets.
Really? I haven't been paying attention to this.
Yeah, so it's been a number of months back, but people are still, I think, almost as mystified as they were in the beginning, where they see this star and the brightness of the star is changing by a large amount in very random ways. So you might expect the brightness of a star to change somewhat in a very periodic way if there's a planet going around it.
Right.
For example, and as Earth goes around the sun, every year someone looking at it would see a dip as the sun got a little bit dimmer because the Earth went across it.
We can predict the transits, like in May we saw the Mercury transit, and we know exactly when the next Mercury transit's going to be.
But here, for example, you see something where a huge amount of the light gets blocked out, and so that suggests something that's actually covering a large fraction of the star, and it's doing it in this very, very random way. And so the best explanation scientifically might be a cloud of comets, although it's very
cloud of comets.
Well, it's very curious, right? Because you would think if it was close enough in, you would see the hot dust from the dust being heated by the star. But the thing that got everyone excited is that one of the authors sort of cheekily said that you could not rule out alien megastructures as causing this sort of these sort of changes in brightness, and maybe this is actually aliens moving the comets around. I think it's sort of fun in our profession that so much is so well understood that it's very rare that we have things where we're just so baffled that we could appeal to something like this, right?
That's awesome.
And for me, that's part of the fun of science, is saying, you know, it doesn't happen very often, but here's one time where we're so confused that we can't even rule out aliens.
That's really cool. So, Betsy, I also know that you have an interest in increasing the broader participation from underrepresented groups. Did you want to talk a little bit about the work you do then?
Yeah, so this is something that I think is incredibly valuable, and this is something that I feel very personally that, you know, experiences that I think many can relate to, you know, that I've had even just as a woman in the field, already can make daily life a little bit hard, or make things a little bit more difficult to do the science that I love.
Absolutely. I mean, I need to worry about what I'm wearing to work, and certainly when I discuss this with my male colleagues, they don't have as much of a problem.
But women are actually getting decently well represented.
Right.
But the problem is that's mostly white women, right? So when you look at it, the fraction of women being represented, for example, at a PhD level or at a faculty level has been increasing. So it's up to, I think, around 40% in the
right.
U.S.
Awesome.
At the grad school level. But the thing is, the same increases haven't been made for women of color, and the same increases really haven't been made for people of color. And when you look at the numbers, it's very disheartening. I think in astronomy, there's often this game that we like to play to feel good where we say, oh, well, our representation of women is better than physics or engineering or computer science. But when you look at the representation of people coming from minority and minoritized groups, it's actually quite poor compared to these other fields. And I think it's really something that we as all astronomers have to step back and look at this and ask, what actions are we taking that have an effect on this? And what can we do to make this better? By talking to the students who are here, by listening to the voices of students and people in these minoritized and underserved groups, and asking what can be improved. So I'm very excited that I'm going to be teaching at a school that's a Hispanic-serving institution, where there's a lot of momentum underway to really work with students and really reach out to students coming from backgrounds where there's a larger fraction of
right.
students who are Hispanic, who are Black. And, you know, actually being able to work and give these students the preparation to succeed in a field that they love.
That's fantastic. So when you and I were in Socorro in 2014, there was a program called the National Astronomy Consortium that started national for the U.S., and I know you continued with this program for the following 2 years. I don't know if you're involved.
Yeah, so this is something that I led for a couple of summers. And this was fun because I had some of the most talented students I worked with. They're truly amazing, right? They're students who inspire me every day. And I had a lot of students, a lot of Latina students and Latino and African-American students, Black students. And we worked with them. So they had a research experience over the summer. So they come in and they do research with us for 10 weeks. And then one of the unique features of this program is that we have weekly meetings that don't just discuss research, but also discuss what's going on personally in the field, right? What are barriers that you might be encountering? Safe space to talk about things that one is feeling and experiencing, getting knowledge and tools to sort of keep going and overcome these things like imposter syndrome, things like stereotype threat that can really sort of preferentially hurt and discriminate against people coming from certain backgrounds. And so then the other thing that's very unique is that we continue to keep in touch with and work with the students after the summer is over. So it's not just saying, hey, you know, come here, you're going to have this great summer, you're going to do research, and after the 10 weeks is up, you're back on your own. But we're actually saying we're continuing to be resources where we keep in touch with students, we keep meeting with students, we keep on giving sort of advice and research and support, not just from us, but from their peers also. So building this really strong peer group so that you have people that you can turn to who are going through the same experiences that you are, and you have a network, right, to help you succeed.
That sounds fantastic. So the program, I know in Socorro at least, started in 2014. So how are those students doing?
They're doing really great, so I'm really, really proud of them. So I believe all of the students now are getting into a program where they will get a master's or a PhD.
Awesome.
And so they're all dealing with moving further on in their career and getting to be better and better astronomers. And they're all over the U.S. So we have students who are in New Mexico and Tennessee at Vanderbilt. We have students who are at Virginia and in Los Angeles at Cal State LA.
My student, I think, ended up in Arizona doing medical physics.
Yeah, well, it's great. I mean, the whole point of this program, too, is, you know, obviously we want to increase the representation for
right.
the people that you're bringing in, for people who are coming from minoritized backgrounds.
What I did want to say was, I'd like to share this anecdote. So when I started my PhD, I was a bit of a skeptic, really. I thought everything should be merit-based. We should all work hard to end up where we are. And my mentors and my supervisors were like, no, you have to understand that the baseline isn't fair. And there have been many steps in the process that are, be it conscious or unconscious, but biased against certain groups of people. And the example that was given to us was, there was this female professor who I respect very much, and I didn't realize she'd only gotten a permanent position very recently at that point. And she said when she was a PhD student of order 2 decades ago, she was told, yeah, fine, at your level, at the PhD level, we're doing really well. It's, you know, 40-60, close to 50-50. But obviously you look at the professor level and there are very few female professors at the really up high up level. And they said, but that's okay. your generation's going to change that. And that was 20 years ago, and it hasn't changed. If you look at the breakdown now, as Betsy said, at the sort of undergraduate, postgrad level, it's close to 50-50, but certainly at the professor level, it's very, very different. And I'm really, really glad to know that there are people out there working on this and caring about it, being mindful that this is something we should be
and
aware
of. And I think
it's
really important to remember that this is for everyone, right?
Absolutely.
By making everything better and more welcoming and more inclusive of people from all backgrounds, so whether that's race, whether that's sexuality, whether that's a disability, you really are making an environment that's better for everyone to work in. And you're also bringing in talent that we're just ignoring right now. And that to me is the terrifying thing. If we are, as astronomers, really only pulling from just one pool of people, that's a huge fraction of society,
right,
of people who can bring these really valuable creative perspectives, of people who can reach out to the next generation, whether it's wonderful and amazing people who can reach out to the public, like Neil deGrasse Tyson, whether it's, like, I have a brilliant friend, Chanda Sue Prescott Weinstein, who is an amazing dark matter researcher, right,
wow,
and is researching, right, the particles that make up dark matter. I mean, these are voices that are so needed, right, and it's terrifying to think about building sort of a field where we're excluding these people.
Absolutely. Well, thank you very much, Betsy, for this awesome interview. I had a lot of fun, and thank you very much.
Thank you, Minnie.